Coming up next on 94.7 WTVC LP Charlottesville, it's Apropos of Something, co-hosted by Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence. Apropos of Something welcomes experts, activists, and the marginalized from our community to discuss how the latest policies are affecting everyday people. Apropos of Something is brought to you by the Beckham team at Keller Williams. And now, here's Ellen.
I am here, Ellen. I am here. I wonder, in the time you've done that intro, care to wager a guess how many people Trump has fired this morning? I'm feeling it. I'm feeling there's someone else is on the chopping block.
Really?
Yeah, well, you know, it's Saturday morning. He's busy on the weekend.
You know,
he's ruined, as I said once, he's ruined the weekend.
Yeah, I know.
So, and officially.
I'm fiddling with some instruments here because I'm running the board today. Could you hear me? I don't know. But I just wanted you to know that it's just you and me, Christine and Phil, and we're going to have a great, great show today.
It's going to be tremendous.
It is. It is. I think my dials are working. I see them working. I don't know if you heard this, but there's a new show on. It's called Housewives of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, Housewives of Washington, D.C. They are particularly vicious and crude lately, would you not say?
Well, I would love to hear an example of this, Ellen. I mean, I'm getting used to not being shocked by anything, but I hope you have something to offer. Go ahead,
well,
I'm sitting, in my studio in New York.
I really can't say any of the words that were said. On the FCC will not allow me, but a lot of expletives.
Yeah.
But I know that Ryan Lizza, the reporter, was called by Scaramucci. I feel like we should have the Queen music every time I say his name coming through. He called
him
to swear.
Well, you should definitely put a pinky ring on when you say his name, I think yeah. That's the least you could do. Anyway, I'm sorry.
Be on the lookout for horse heads. So I couldn't believe that he called the reporter, and then he was surprised that the reporter would actually report on it when it was on the record. And he's the communications director.
Yeah.
And ask for his source. That's crazy.
Yeah, I know.
Crazy.
And he'll probably be the one, even though for some reason everyone thinks that the new chief of staff, well, soon to be, whatever, General Kelly, is not going to tolerate this guy, but Scaramucci totally seems like Trump's id, you know, like his reflection in the mirror. I cannot see that guy going, which means General Kelly is going to be going, I would imagine. I don't know. I'm very curious which one of these two. I just don't see them both surviving the general house staff of the White House, if that ever becomes a show. And speaking of that show, did you happen to read or see that moment in the press briefing sometime during the week when Ms. Sanders actually opened a press briefing? I think it was the day that the transgender ban was just randomly tweeted. Anyway, she started that press conference with a piece of fan mail. I'm a 9-year-old.
Oh.
Did you even know that this existed? That he had started. She had started.
No.
Yeah, it was a total. I'm sure. Well, I don't know for sure, but it sounded so orchestrated. I don't really know if 9-year-old Dylan does exist, but she took however many minutes out of a news day to, because of course, you know, as you know, Trump is always watching these things, just to read this 9-year-old's total fan.
Mm-hmm.
Teen beat.
I did not know
letter
that.
to his president.
Well, speaking
it was another jaw dropping moment.
Speaking
in
of boys, I'd like to talk about the Boy Scout event where Twitler was at the rally. I thought all we needed was Leni Riefenstahl to make that scene complete. You know about the Boy Scout rally, and the Boy Scouts were forced to apologize for him. And I wanted to do a little visualization for our listeners today. If you would, close your eyes, and I'm going to tell you what the Scouts motto really is. And then just imagine if BLOTUS fits any of these things. Trustworthy, loyal, helpful, friendly, courteous, kind, obedient, cheerful, thrifty, brave, clean, and reverent. The end. Are you there?
There's no, I don't know, self-serving, divisive, incoherent part of the pledge. So no, I don't. Creepy? Was
creepy.
That in there?
It really bothered me.
Yeah, actually, in full disclosure, that was my news of note. So I have other points, but
oh, yeah,
I thought that that he took that moment and a very, as you know, very neutral organization out there of 14-year-olds and turned them into his super PAC. I thought that mm-hmm. was just unbelievable. You know, his usual personal score settling and throwing everyone, you know, his usual suspects, Obama, Hillary,
right.
the
mm-hmm.
media, mm-hmm. you know, it was so disgraceful, disgusting, to use his word. Everything he touches, right? It's
yeah.
just, he diminishes everything.
So something that we can do about it in town here, moveon.org is hosting a Charlottesville Neighborhood Listening Project today at 1 o'clock at the Jefferson Madison Regional Library. And what it is training for door knocking in neighborhoods and then going out and talking to people because, as they say that, it, you know, the country is very divided, but when you talk to people, it can be more nuanced. So they're hoping to, get into discussions with people to empower them. And Nancy, you know, when I was thinking about this, you and I, way back in the early days, we went door knocking.
Yeah.
We had, yeah. right? Do you remember that?
Yeah, Freeman, Bill, Bob.
Yeah,
somebody.
Bill Freeman, I think. So we would go around in Minneapolis door to door as part of like some extra credit.
That guy extra had some hair too, as I recall from the pictures. We would fold into envelopes.
Yeah.
Right? Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, but it's just funny. I don't know if we've come for a full circle.
Yeah, we did that for pop points.
Mm-hmm.
We must have. We were always doing it for something.
Yep.
At least I was.
Extra
there was credit involved.
Yeah. There were the beautiful.
I do remember that.
Beautiful fall days in Minnesota, I remember.
Yeah. Bill Frenzel.
Yeah, Bill Frenzel. I think it was the first one you said. Anyway, let's get right to
He was running against Bill Frenzel.
Yes.
Sure.
Oh, yeah. The incumbent, probably. So we do have an amazing, amazing show.
Yes.
Our first guest is Christine Mahoney. She is co-founder of the Alight Fund, empowering refugee entrepreneurs to grow small businesses in displacement-affected zones. Her book, now available in paperback, is Failure and Hope, Fighting for the Rights of the Forcibly Displaced. She is professor of public policy and politics at the Frank Batten School of Leadership and Public Policy, and also director of the social entrepreneurship at the University of Virginia. Welcome, Christine.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's our pleasure. So, as you say in your book, you've been all over the world on tuk-tuks, rickshaws, bicycles, buses. You've been studying displacement crises, including 7 conflict zones around the world. You've interviewed 170 humanitarian aid workers, government officials, and refugees. That's a lot. Can you give us a picture, a snapshot of the problem, how many refugees there are, and what are they facing?
Sure. So this last year, we actually made a new record globally where there's 65 million people displaced by violent conflict. So these are people essentially fleeing war zones. This is not people fleeing a hurricane. And the new normal is that these people will be displaced for years and often decades. So, for example, I was in Burmese refugee camps in Thailand where people have been displaced for over 20 years. Bhutanese refugee camps in Nepal, also over 20 years. And as many of the listeners know, the Syria crisis is now going into year 5 and 6. And so people have now been displaced for a half a decade. So that's the new normal. Unfortunately, our humanitarian kind of aid machine is about temporary. The idea was that you'd be displaced for a couple weeks, a couple months, and in that time you'd have a temporary tent and some temporary food, and then you'd go home. But the problem is if you've been displaced for a decade or 2 decades, and all you have is a tent and some temporary food relief, that's not living, right? That's a life of limbo. And so that's why I was interested in writing this book, trying to understand, you know, where is there some success stories out there? Where have aid organizations been able to fight for these people's rights? Especially another thing I want to point out is often people are not allowed to work and they're not allowed to move freely. So they're essentially worse off than the extremely poor because of national policies and international policy. They're not allowed to take care of themselves and their families. And so what I found in case after case is no success stories. Unfortunately, nowhere are really people allowed to work or move freely. Everywhere, people are stuck in limbo, and it's no way to live. And so that's why I wrote the book and am proposing a new solution, a different way forward, one that invests in small businesses and entrepreneurs and the host communities that welcome them, so that we can, you know, create a situation of economic growth to support those welcoming new refugees as well as the refugees themselves.
And I was just wondering, Christine, how long, you know, in your research did it take for you to arrive at this solution? Because I know you've been all over. Was it apparent right away just that this idea of just feeding them isn't going to solve this?
Actually, I wish I could say that was the case. No, it took me about 8 years. So I was doing the fieldwork, and I guess I'm somewhat naturally idealistic or optimistic, and I kept thinking, I'm going to find a case where the aid workers and the UN have been successful in advocating for these people's right to work. And I kept going to more war zones and refugee camps and internal displacement camps and kept finding that to be not the case. And as an academic at a policy school, I really wanted to write a conclusion that actually put something forward, a useful proposal. And I was stuck for a year, to be honest. I was trying to come up with creative advocacy strategies. My background is advocacy. My first book was looking at advocacy and activism in the United States and the European Union. And for the life of me, I didn't really buy any of the ideas I came up with. So it took me a little longer than I planned. But at the same time, I was building the social entrepreneurship at the University of Virginia program and reading about really innovative microfinance strategies, really innovative social enterprise strategies and hybrid models. And it was really through that work for the university that I realized that we needed a new approach to the refugee crisis.
Do you think the Syrian crisis is, sadly, you know, helping you in only this way, you know, draw more attention to these more permanent, the entrepreneurship solutions, is that it gets much more press than just the refugee? Do you think it helps?
Interesting. Yes, I think, and it's, you know, for 7 years I was doing this fieldwork, and in my mind it was a global refugee crisis, though no one was referring to it as that. In the middle of my work, there was 35 million people displaced, and that was a big problem. But it was really not getting any coverage at all. Actually, the first two substantive chapters in my book look at media coverage in the United States and the European Union over a decade. And what I found is the vast majority of forcibly displaced crises, so there's 65 of them burning worldwide, 60% of them receive no news coverage whatsoever. So sadly, the Syrian crisis did shine a light on it in a way that I think has been helpful. Because of the crisis getting so bad, many of your listeners may know, during the UN General Assembly last September, there was a big focus on the refugee problem. President Obama founded something called the Partnership for Refugees, which has been taken over by the Tent Foundation, which is funded by the entrepreneur that started Chobani, who really believes in supporting refugees. And so all of these different people are focusing on the need to do something different, the need to move toward long-term economic development, and the need to engage the private sector and investors and businesses, because the problem is so big, it can't be solved by government or the UN alone.
Well, being that 60%, you know, isn't probably still getting coverage, please explain the process of getting anyone in a room, investors, you know, to how do you even start doing that part, which I know is integral. You need the money to get these people on their, you know, on their feet.
Well, thankfully, the founder of Chobani has made a major commitment, a few $100 million. George Soros has also shined light on this problem and has committed $500 million to invest in this space. So that's been very helpful. You have kind of two luminaries really saying that they're going to put their own capital up, and then that can be encouraging to others. With the Tent Partnership and the President Obama's Partnership for Refugees, that really encouraged, I think, over 70 different private sector companies like IKEA and Visa and MasterCard, to make commitments. And so that's gone a long way. And then there's been a lot of convening. So last September, there was a number of convenings. The Alight Fund, which I co-founded, co-convened a solution summit in London a few weeks ago with the Boston Consulting Group, who's also very passionate about this issue. And interestingly, you know, we don't need, because as you pointed out, there's a lot of media attention now. And since the crisis is so big in Europe, and that's having a really big impact on European countries, people are just coming to the table. We're not really needing to drag them to the table. And so we had major international financial institutions like the World Bank, major investors like the Soros Fund, And the World Food Program, who is, you know, trying to feed millions of people, and a number of NGOs coming to the table as well. So really people are realizing that something needs to be done. And then now we're in the phase of figuring out what are the nuts and bolts? How do we get the investment to the entrepreneurs on the ground? How do we grow and scale companies that are serving and employing refugees and host communities? And how do we kind of directly improve lives?
Can you talk more about those details, what your fund is seeking to do?
So the Alight Fund specifically, we founded to do microfinance. And so we began, our plan was to begin in northern Iraq, in the Kurdish region of Iraq. As many of your listeners know, Mosul was recently liberated. ISIS is a challenge in northern Iraq, but Kurdistan is actually quite stable. It has a pretty progressive government that is very interested in economic development. And the Kurdish, so there's Kurdish refugees from Syria in the Kurdish region of Iraq, and they've been welcomed very warmly. They're allowed to work. They're allowed to legally work by the Iraqi constitution. And so our plan was to begin doing raising a microfinance fund to invest in refugee and host community entrepreneurs there. We've gone and done a number of field trips there. Met with government officials. There's a lot of pros, as I just discussed, but there's a lot of challenges right now as well. The price of oil has gone down. The government doesn't have any money. There's challenges between the central bank and the Bank of Baghdad. So there's a number of things that is slowing that work right now. So the long-term goal is to raise funds to do microfinance for refugees. But in the meantime, we're looking at alternative ways that we can support that work. And so last month, we partnered with the Tent Foundation, USA for the UNHCR, and Kiva to raise additional funds for Kiva's World Refugee Fund. The idea there is to get microfinance banks that are working on the ground, lending to local poor people, to begin lending to refugees so we can start collecting data and show that refugees are a good bet. Refugees know their businesses. They may have lost everything, but they didn't lose their knowledge of how to run a business and know their skill set, whether they're a mechanic or a baker. And we want to show that is a good bet. And we're helping fund that so we can collect better data so that we can grow more investment.
You know, I have a feeling your answer will be cut in between with a commercial, but I will start with asking you, that data that you show investors, how do you accumulate it?
Well, this first partnership with Kiva is, Kiva works with a number of microfinance institutions on the ground in refugee hosting countries, and so we'll be working with them. The most important data to collect is repayment rates. And then with some of the nonprofits, we can collect information on, you know, is this improving lives? Is this improving the economic stability of households?
This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We're talking with Christine Mahoney, co-founder of the Alight Fund, empowering refugee entrepreneurs to grow small businesses. We're going to continue talking with her, but you can find the fund online at alightfund.com. That's one L. And on Twitter at Alight Fund. We will be back after this. Welcome back. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Apropos with myself, Ellen Daniels, and Nancy Lawrence in our New York studio. We're talking with Christine Mahoney, co-founder of the Alight Fund, empowering refugee entrepreneurs.
Well, I'm not sure, actually, but Christine, were you done describing how you convince or assure investors that, you know, their money is doing what it's supposed to do with this data?
Yes, I think so. Okay. I mean, we'll continue to collect more. Obviously, the more data, the more convincing.
Okay, fair enough. I was also curious, the countries you've been to, what are they? And are there stories, the refugee stories that you see there, are they similar? Or are they all different in ways that you're about to say, if I would end my question?
Sure. I did field work on the Somali border and the Somali refugee camps in Kenya, just over the border in Kenya. Ugandan internal displacement camps in northern Uganda during the Lord's Resistance Army fighting. Internal displacement camps in paramilitary controlled zones in Colombia related to the paramilitary and ELN and FARC fighting in Colombia. Bhutanese refugee camps in Nepal. Many people know of Bhutan as the happiest place on earth, but they also kicked out a lot of their citizens. And they've been stuck in refugee camps for 20 years. Most of those have been resettled. In 2007, the United States took the majority of them. Burma, many people know that there's a junta there that's very violent, that has cracked down on the Karen and the Karenian, and they're in refugee camps in Thailand. I did field work in Kosovo refugee camps and Croatian IDP camps and Sri Lankan internal displacement camps. And I think that was most of them. So a lot of the stories are similar. You know, we actually heard a public service announcement at the beginning of the show, and one of the refugees interviewed said, you know, I wasn't born a refugee. These are people that had businesses, they had careers, and their lives were interrupted by fighting that had nothing to do with them. So I spoke with a woman who was kicked out of Serbia, and she had been in a refugee camp since 1994. When I was there, it was the first country I did field work in. And she told me this heartbreaking story where her daughter was about to start college. You know, many of us have that experience. You know, you remember that you were supposed to go away to college your freshman year. And her life got horribly interrupted, and they got forced into a refugee camp. They got pushed across a river at Bayonet Point. And her parents have, you know, PTSD and are suffering from mental health issues. And this girl never got to live her life. She's just stuck taking care of her parents in a essentially dwindling and dying refugee camp, a crisis that has long been forgotten. So many of these cases, people have been displaced. You know, there was Burundian refugees displaced from Burundi into Tanzania in 1976, and they were still there in the early 2000s. So many of these people, with very little help and very little media attention, are stuck in limbo for a very long time.
The statistics are really staggering. 33,972 people forced to flee their homes daily because of violent conflict around the world. There were 715,000 asylum-seeking applications to the European Union. And as you mentioned, 65 million people are displaced by violent conflict around the world. What is the international community doing, and what are the responsibilities that they have or they've agreed to?
Well, it's interesting. We know we have a UN declaration on the status of refugees, and many nations are signatories to that. And we agree to protect people that are essentially fleeing persecution. And so through the UN and the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, the bare level of support is covered. But every year, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees has to ask for more money and for appeals to take care of all of these crises. And they're often not funded fully as they are needed. So just the basic food, medicine, shelter is hardly getting funded. And then there's 10 other categories that are also not getting funded. So the international response has been, you know, as I mentioned, very temporary and just essentially keeping people alive. The burden really falls on what we call countries of first asylum. So this is Jordan, Lebanon, northern Iraq, the countries that people flee to first. Right now, you know, Kenya from the South Sudan conflict that just has blown up again. And so that's what I'm arguing in my book, and many of the people I'm working with in collaboration are arguing. The international community and the private sector business community really needs to step up and start supporting these host countries, because they're doing a huge job. Their own citizens are already struggling. They're often emerging markets and countries that are poor themselves. And then they're taking on the burden of, you know, millions upon millions of forcibly displaced people.
And being that you are, or, you know, all these investors, all these countries are in so many different areas, it's obviously such a political environment, each case being different. How nimble do you have to be with the work you're doing with these people you are, you know, you choose to support? How does that work for you guys?
Sure. I described a little bit about the challenges in Iraq. So we were, you know, very much looking forward to working in northern Iraq and the Kurdish region. And because of the challenges of ISIS and of Mosul and of the, you know, global price of oil and a number of other conditions, that work needs to be delayed a bit. We also, you know, so we're looking right now, you know, does Jordan look like the best option? You know, who are our partners? Where are people willing to invest? Where is stable enough to invest? You know, there's opportunities to invest in microfinance in Somalia, but, you know, many people are very concerned about the security in Somalia. So it's really trying to figure out a balance of what does the investment opportunities look like, as well as what does the security situation look like, and what are investors' needs to feel kind of confident that they'll be able to invest in a productive way. So it is a bit dynamic. You know, we've only been doing this for about a year now, and we're trying to figure out the most effective way to do it.
how has the travel ban affected your work, your ability to get to these places, and how does it affect the refugees?
Well, thankfully, it hasn't affected us too much yet. At first, it appeared that it was. When Trump passed the Muslim ban at first, one of those countries was Iraq. And so the Iraqi parliament was going to retaliate with a ban against Americans, which would have immediately meant we couldn't even go and do our work. Other, you know, nonprofits that are just trying to keep people alive also would have a hard time doing their work. Thankfully, the Iraqi parliament took a more enlightened view than our administration has. And they didn't pass that policy. So people are still able to do their work. But of course, it's, you know, it creates a hostile kind of climate, I think, toward American policy. But that's one of the benefits, too, of what we're doing is I think we can bypass some of the bad policy coming out of the U.S. administration. Obviously, it looks like, you know, our refugee ban will continue. The Muslim ban is continuing. And our cap on how many refugees we'll take to resettle is going to probably be much lower during this administration than it has been for over a decade. However, we can still do something. We can still support the vast majority of the displaced in the countries that they are living in. And we can do it through the private sector and bypass government.
So as we wrap up in the next couple of minutes, what do you think people can do that are listening? What can listeners do?
Sure. I mean, thankfully, Charlottesville is a really welcoming place. And we have an International Rescue Committee office here that does really fantastic work welcoming the few refugees that we will be able to bring in this year. So supporting the IRC is a great way. Also, Charlottesville has just been designated a welcoming city. We're part of Welcoming America now. So in September, I think September 15 to the 24th, we're going to be having a welcoming week. And we have a new organization that I'm on the task force called Welcoming Greater Charlottesville. So that week is going to be a week of celebrating immigrant rights, refugee rights, and celebrating the diversity that new Americans essentially bring to our communities and how that makes our economy richer and it makes our culture richer and it makes our fiction maybe richer, which we're going to be talking about in a second. So I encourage people to kind of keep their eye out for those exciting events and come on out and support them.
How do you engage? I know because we barely addressed the fact that you're a teacher, you're a professor as well. So how does the work you're doing, how do you engage your students at the social entrepreneurship program you run?
Well, it's actually kind of interesting. The students are really interested and excited about this, but I've been trying to figure it out from a conflict of interest standpoint. I believe that we need to move towards social enterprise to solve this problem. But when you talk about a social enterprise and not a nonprofit, a lot of people are concerned about conflict of interest. So unfortunately, like I've had lots of students interested in like, I want to work for the Alight Fund. I'm like, I don't think I can hire you. So right now, I think it's mostly just been from a exciting and encouraging standpoint. I think they're glad to see a faculty member doing something and trying to have an impact on the world and not just writing about it. But from a conflict of interest standpoint, I cannot hire them or take them on as interns. So hopefully it'll just inspire them to do their own thing and start their own organization.
Thank you so much, Christine Mahoney, co-founder of the Alight Fund, empowering refugees worldwide towards self-reliance and dignity. Their website is alightfund.com. That's one L. And they can be found on Twitter at Alight Fund. Thank you so much, Christine.
Thanks for having me.
Yes.
Thanks.
And in a moment, we're going to be talking with Philip Jason. But before that, Nancy.
Yes, my news of note.
I took it from you. I stole you. I stole yours.
That's all right. That's okay. I could easily apply, which I might as well in broader strokes, Trump's creepy, self-serving, divisive, incoherent speech that he did, I believe it was just yesterday, in front of the police force in Suffolk County in New York, making sure to get all these gory details in and painting that American carnage that he's so fond of, and of course, making me feel anyway like the men and women serving behind him, the police behind him, should have been wearing brown shirts and red armbands. It was another disturbing performance by the president after a morning of threatening the citizens of Alaska with a tweet because Senator Murkowski voted against the skinny repeal blank piece of paper. Anyway, so I will still cede the floor to Trump and his shameful. He has no shame, but his breaking of yet another chance, you know, ruining another chance to just do the simplest of tasks, and instead, you know, just making everyone uneasy and frightening.
It was disgraceful, and the way he said, "You don't have to put your," you know, the way you put. He's talking to the cops. The way you put them into the car, you don't have to put your hand. You don't have to be so nice. You know, I think something he might need a little bit later is you're innocent until proven guilty. I think he forgot about that.
I know. The Constitution, it's for suckers. I know. Yeah. I know. Unbelievable. Yeah. I am waiting for him to... he will, actually. You know, I bet you, Ellen, he will wind up prompted, of course, to be at a children's hospital for something, and he's going to discuss with his kids voter fraud. You know, he can't stop talking about himself and his one victory, which of course he doesn't really believe.
If I could say one thing to people that are in his audiences, why do they then clap, applaud, laugh, whatever? And that also really bothers me. I don't know if it's like an uncomfortable crowd mentality thing, you know, but don't give him any positive feedback for that. And, you know, I'm glad that there's blowback after some of this stuff, at least from the rest of us. Anyhow, thank you for that. Bringing that up,
I'm
all riled up.
Myself. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, good point to bring that up. So I'd like to welcome our next guest. He is writer Philip Jason, second-year graduate student at the University of Virginia and winner of the 2017 Henfield Prize for Fiction, one of the most prestigious individual prizes available to promising writers. Welcome, Phil.
Hello.
Hi.
Thanks for having me.
Hey.
Yeah,
you're very welcome. So since you're a writer, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into writing. If you could make it into a story, this is cheesy, I know, but tell us a little bit about your path to finding the career that you hopefully love.
It's been a long time. Like, you know, in fact, so it begins, I'm in college, and I think I started writing poetry because I was sad about losing a girl. Like that's the true beginning. I was writing these, like, I remember writing a poem that was called like Dead Roses Red, and it was like not a beat, not the smallest part still beats within my too shattered heart. I mean, like, this was like some of the first writing that I did.
It's good to get that stuff out, and then the other stuff can follow.
And then I took a history of science fiction class when I was like a sophomore. And it's weird. It's like they made us do a lot of reading, like really a lot of reading. I think we read like 30 books in the semester, which is, even I think at a collegiate level, is a significant amount of reading. And I don't know, something just happened while I was doing all the reading where I was just kind of like, oh, I kind of want to do this. So that led to a phone call to my parents being like, hey, this summer, I don't want to work. And this didn't go over well with my mom, not even a little bit. I mean, at the time I was enrolled in business school at the University of Pennsylvania. So, I mean, we were expected
to be. That's another way to get chicks too. I can't believe this didn't work out better for you right at the get go. Anyway.
Yeah. So we were supposed to like get like summer jobs on Wall Street and whatever. And I was like, nah, I'm going to do writing for a summer. And, I graduated and I guess I kind of just, like, I don't know, something just, I had half finished a novel and then I went on to do other things. I ended up becoming a house music producer or composer, however you want to look at it. Like, I was making house music that people were putting out on like vinyl records back in the early 2000s, and that came to an end, and I started writing again a little bit, and yada yada. Like, I went through this whole phase of like, I reached a point where I was like, writing is silly. Like, there's just this is a waste of my time on this planet. I don't know what was going through my head, and so I just shelved it as an idea entirely. And then again, I guess I was like, you know, a couple years after that, I just woke up one day. I was like, I want to do this. And it was the first time that like I really wanted to be a writer. Like, I just was like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to set out to do this. And That was about 7 years ago, and since then I've just kind of been working at it. You know, it's a slow grind, you know.
So Philip Jason, we're talking to him. We'll continue talking to him after this break. He is a second-year grad student at UVA, winner of the prestigious Henfield Prize for Fiction in 2017. We'll be right back. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. You're listening to Apropos of Something, airing every Saturday from 10 to 11. I'm here with Nancy in New York City and Philip Jason, writer and winner of the Henfield Prize for Fiction.
So you were speaking of this slow grind, Phil, and I was wondering, you must have submitted work to journals and magazines, and what I'm asking is, how much rejection did you hear, and could you give us some details from your It's Never Going to Happen for You, Sir file? Knowing that it eventually did is the only reason that I'm asking.
Well, first of all, you were talking in, like, the past tense, as if the rejection had stopped.
Yeah.
I don't think it ever does, you know, until you really reach a certain strange echelon where, like, suddenly people stop saying no to you. But there was a... There's a lot of rejection. You send out pieces at first, and there's a learning process where you start to understand what's actually happening. Because at first you get these letters back saying, no, this is no good, and you're thinking, oh man, you know, this is all on me. Like, I'm not a good writer. And I guess over time, like, you learn things. You start to figure out that, first of all, like, these magazines are, you know, these days are receiving thousands of submissions. So it's not that your pieces are necessarily getting a great deal of attention. You know, if you were a reader at a magazine, you might have to read like 100 stories in a week, and that's exhausting. So you start taking it a little less personally. I mean, the big moment is really that first acceptance. And for me, the first acceptance was really weird, because first of all, I didn't even know it had happened. So there's like this online service called Submittable that basically all these magazines use now, where you submit your story through them and they set, like, you know, they use that to respond to you. So if they accept, they click a little button and you're supposed to get an email. So, you know, I was looking at the site and I just was, I guess, bored one day. I was playing around and you can, like, click on this one link that, like, just shows you all the stories that have been accepted. And I don't even know why I clicked on it on, like, my little page. And suddenly there was a story there. And I was like, this is weird. I didn't get any sort of email. And then I looked through my spam folder. And sure enough, there was an email from, like, 2 weeks earlier that this magazine wanted this story. So I got in touch with them. And they were like, yes, you know, I was terrified that I was too late. Like, I didn't know how slow things really were. Like, I was like, oh, my God, they think I don't want to be published. Now, flash forward 6 months. This story doesn't have the happiest ending. So I wait 6 months to hear from them again. And then I get an email from the editor being like, oh, hey, Phil, so here's the deal. We want to cut 3,500 words from your 4,000-word story and just publish it like this. And I wrote back. I was like, then that's not my story anymore. And then she wrote back, how dare you, pretty much. Like, you know, I have been published in the Paris Review and all of these things. How dare you question my editorial, you know, wisdom? So I was really bummed that my first acceptance turned out to be not an acceptance. But then, like, a month later, I received another acceptance, and that story was eventually published in, like, the, in fact, it's the review that they do in the program at NYU. It's called Washington Square Review. So they published a story of mine, and, like, once you get that, just that thing that says, hey, you can do it, it gets easier. Like, you suddenly your eyes open a little bit to what's really going on. You realize that all these rejections aren't necessarily personal. And then it's still, like, you know, the thing is, it's still a very slow grind. Like, it's still.
And speaking of success, tell us about the Henfield Prize.
Oh, the Henfield. So it's a prize they give out.
Is it too much of a burden to talk about?
I know.
So much. Like, everyone is always like, people come up to me on the street these days and they're like, you look like a Henfield winner.
Well, I've mentioned it 50,000 times, so I gotta ask you.
So it's, you know, like, you come into the UVA program and you know that this is a prize that they give out. And like, we don't, like, you know, the people in the program, we don't sit around talking about it all year, but it's a thing because, I mean, it's a significant cash prize. It's a $10,000 prize. And as a writer, like as a writer at almost any stage in your career, like most of these magazines, they publish your stories for free. Like, they don't give you any money. And even the ones that do pay, you're talking about, like, if you got $500 for a story, that's big. Like, so, you know, $10,000 for anything in the writing world is it's a significant sort of thing. So, you know, it's in your mind. You're like, oh, it would be nice to win the Henfield. And, you know, so I submitted my story. I didn't think I was going to win. Like, there are other students in the program who were producing fiction that I just loved. And then I was just like, oh, this guy, you know, I was like, maybe I'll come in second. This would be nice. Like, I'm definitely not going to get first. I'll take second or third, like, you know, and then maybe have a shot at it next year. And so I submitted, and I really wasn't thinking much of it. And then the school year had just ended, and I had to go back to New York. You know, I just was coming back to New York for a few weeks because that's where I'm from originally. I was going to visit my parents and whatever. And the ride back to New York was horrific. Like, you know, it's supposed to take about 7 hours. It took 9 hours because there was an enormous amount of traffic from Staten Island, you know, all the way to like the LIE, which I know both Ellen and Nancy are familiar with these terms. People in Charleston are like, what's the LIE? The lie? Yes, it's a lie to think you're going to move at all on that highway. It is not an expressway. It is, you know, people just park their cars there.
It's the Long Island Expressway.
Yeah, it's the Long Island Expressway. It's so, I mean, I was in a terrible mood. We went to dinner. Like, I got home. We went to dinner, like, with my parents. And we're coming back from the dinner, and I'm driving. Because I think both my mom and it was Cinco de Mayo, so that's like my mom's favorite day of the year. She gets her margaritas on, and so like my parents had margaritas. So I'm driving, and like I shouldn't have been checking my email. I realize I should, you know, but I check and I see that like there, you know, there's an email announcing the winner, and so like I open it and I'm like, let's see who won, you know, like obviously not me. And I'm looking and I'm reading it, and it just says like, you know, the name of my story, which is Heart Safe, Phil Jason, winner. And I was like, and like, there's, you know, it's small text. I'm like, I'm misreading this. Like, I'm definitely like, you know, and my mom starts screaming. She's like, Phil, pay attention to the road. And I was like, be quiet, mom. This is big. Like, and so like, I had to hand the phone to the back seat where somebody else was able to actually look at it and be like, oh my God, you did win. And it was definitely, I forgot about all the traffic. I forgot about the traffic that I had been sitting in all day. It was a really nice end to a grueling day. And it was surreal. Like, you know, for a few days afterwards, you're just sort of like, nah, this didn't really happen, you know.
And the way they did it, it's like they just CC'd you on your check, you know. You know, it's amazing. That is so underplayed, like Fight Club or something.
Yeah, I was like, you know, I was like, oh, I hope there's a big check. I hope there's like, you know, there's a big Ed McMahon-style Publishers Clearing House check in this for me. And no, like, it was just, you know, like, it's the honor of winning the prize is really more important, you know, than the money itself. I mean, so there was no, like, ceremony or anything, but I thought that was kind of funny that I just get an email. They're like, you know, please pay Phil his money. And that was it.
Phil, you're listening. Like,
you know, where's my big check?
What, I know you don't know much about the prize, but for people listening, can you at least please tell us what, like, the circumstance of it, how it gets, how you won it?
So it used to be a prize that, like, I think that this foundation called the McCrindle Foundation would give out to students, and like they would do it directly to like the best writing coming out of MFA programs in the United States. And then a couple years ago, they just endowed like five of the top MFA programs in the country to give this prize to one of their students. So, I mean, the first qualification for the prize is you have to get into the program at one of these schools, you know. And these are like UVA is one of the top schools, and like I think the admission rates are really low. It's something like, you know, like one in 150 people get in. Then once you're in the program, towards the end of the year, you are allowed to submit a piece of unpublished writing. You submit it anonymously, like they know you submit like a cover sheet to the administrative Barbara, like who's wonderful. Barbara like runs all, just does a lot of the administrative work. Yes, kind of wish she was listening. I love Barbara. So she knows who everybody. She's the only one who actually knows who all the stories belong to. And then they give the stories to a judge. Like some, we don't know who the judge is at the time. Like it's an anonymous thing, but they usually get a sort of well-respected writer to judge it. And then the judge picks a story, sends it back. Barbara figures out whose story is whose, and then they announce it.
What did you do?
A well-respected writer. Out of here. Can you put yourself down a little bit more?
No. I mean, they pick a well-respected writer to judge the contest.
I know.
So what do you do with that kind of money? I mean, as a writer, does that allow you to chill out a little bit and write, or do you just save it? Or
I mean, it depends. Like, I have a plan for a work that I want to do that would involve traveling. And so that might be something that I could use that for, like to do a little trip.
Where do you want to go?
Everywhere. I mean, like it's a project that involves like really traveling the world. So, you know, that's not free. Yeah. You know, no matter how much you backpack, like it's still.
What made you, what made you choose the piece that you did for this contest?
Oh.
HeartSafe.
This is a piece that, like, as a writer, as any kind of artist, I think people would assume that you write things and you're gonna love and everything you write, and that's not how it is. Like I've written pieces that I just simply didn't care that much for, and some of those pieces have been some of my best successes, like, you know, so it's kind of a weird thing, but this was a piece that, like, I really loved, because it, you know, I when I was writing it, I just kind of like put aside all the rules. I put aside, like, I was just like, I'm just gonna write whatever I feel like writing in the moment. The piece is kind of bizarre in that sort of way, and so I just loved it. Like, I loved what I had done in that particular piece. And
what was the piece about?
So it's about
again.
No. Sorry. Like,
No.
It's about, so there's a guy, and whenever his parents, whenever his parents come to visit him, he, takes, his heart and he puts it in a vault to keep it safe. And he forgets the combination. And so he needs to hire a bunch of, like, people to help him break into his own vault to get his heart back.
Wow. So I like that.
I'm sure my parents are listening or trying to right now. Hi, Mom. Hi, Dad.
Trying. Yeah.
That's why you're having trouble describing this piece. All right.
Yeah, no wonder.
I didn't think about the listening audience.
They've read it. It's okay. Read it. Yeah.
Do you describe your work with as a style? Do you see it as a genre, or is it totally the opposite?
It's really,
think of the work.
It's really difficult for me to, like, it actually makes it harder for me as a writer that I can't specifically put it in a genre. I mean, the genre, like, it's a tradition, like, you know, it has a lot of magical elements, like, you know, it's sort of weird. I bend the rules of reality. Like, my view on it is that I don't distinguish between, like, what is dream and what is, you know, what we consider waking life. And so, like, the two can kind of merge and you can have weird things happening, like people taking their hearts out, you know, which you would see in a dream and maybe think was weird, but not think too much of it. But to think of it as, like, actually happening, like, I write those things as if they're really happening.
Thank you so much for being here, Phil. Yeah. Jason,
thank you for having me again.
Yeah. UVA winner of the Henfield Prize for Fiction and a very interesting person, apparently. So thanks for being here. Also,
but don't tell his parents, Ellen. Do not.
And also thanks to Christine Mahoney, co-founder of the Alight Fund. They're at alightfund.com, empowering refugees. Nance.
Yes, I do, Ellen. I'm playing Radar O'Reilly. I do have a palate cleanser.
What do you got?
The U.S. men's national soccer team, of which I admit I have no interest, but nonetheless, they won the Gold Cup on Wednesday. They beat Jamaica 2-1. It was the 10th time they've gotten to the finals, the 6th time they've won it. And the interesting part about all that to me is that it helps them qualify for the World Cup. It doesn't guarantee it yet, but the World Cup happens to be in Russia this year. So that'll be interesting. Should they continue on their ways, that would be... Mm-hmm. Anyway, but hope, you know what? Hopefully by then, what's-his-name and it won't be such a noteworthy final footnote to the problem here.
Is there polonium in the cup? I fear for their lives, actually. People are dropping like flies. Well, thanks for that, sports. I'm so out of the loop with sports because of just being encumbered or engrossed with all this other stuff. So thanks. Let's talk about baseball again another day. I kind of like that. And I know you love baseball.
I do. And I will admit it makes it harder to really enjoy every game that I do watch, because he oozes into everything. And anyway, yes. Thank God for baseball.
We didn't mention the health. Yeah, well, you did mention it with McCroskey, but at least the health care, the Trump care thing failed, and she's
Ellen,
really
did
some
it
of
really?
These.
I mean, I know it did, but honestly, I don't mean to cut off. I was as pleased as apparent. I know you were too that night, but I have to say, as soon as it failed, I just thought they're already sneaking some other blank piece of paper. They're already putting something together.
But still, we should give some kudos to the senators and the women. And it wasn't only McCain who was the hero, who came in at the last minute and gets all the credit. There were the others.
Murkowski and Collins.
Yes, thank you. The women from Maine and Alaska and a couple of others. So write to them and keep calling them. And at 1 o'clock, there's a move on .org event to canvas neighborhoods and get a chance to talk to your neighbors.
Yeah, it's a full-time job, this side job of being an American citizen these days. Anyway,
I wanted to just do a shout-out to our theme music from Springtide in Japan, and we will see you next week. Thanks, Nance. Thanks for
Ellen,
doing
thank
it.
You as well.
Okay.
From the New York studio.